I'd like to welcome everyone to the quarterly meeting of the Investment Council Committee for the City of Ocala. It's approximately 2 minutes after nine. I'm going to take roll for the official. Danny's our stenographer. We're going to be losing Danny next week. She's going to golf. But anyway, let's take roll. Kent Nguyen is absent. Mayor, City Manager Matt Brower.
We're here.
All right. Chief Financial Officer John Leggy.
Here.
Deputy Director of Budget and Finance Cindy Kelly.
Present.
Mary Ann Davis, Controller.
She's
absent. Myself, Richard Horn, the Cash Investment Manager, and Marie Brooks, Treasury Analyst.
Here.
All right. First item on the agenda is to review the minutes. Do we have any changes or amendments to the minutes?
I move we approve the minutes.
Second.
Motion carried.
All in favor.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right. With that said, we're going to rotate our investment managers, and Stable Rivers, the first one up. They need to review the September 30th quarter.
Just ended. If I can interject just really quick, just so the group understands, Kent Nguyen, as you know, has been a longtime member of this committee. And he won the election for mayor. And so in about 25 days or so, he's going to move from his current seat as a council member to the seat as mayor. And so we'll look to see if we can't get a new appointee to come in and represent the city council on this committee. In fact, I'll look to bring that before council next week at the regular meeting and see if they can't make that appointment at that time.
Congratulations to you.
Yeah.
Well, I think Stable River is first up. I imagine that many of us experienced a lot of the same phenomena in the investment portfolios this quarter because it was so pronounced in the marketplace. I'd like to pick up after tab one on slide two and discuss a couple of the highlights from the third quarter. Also of note, I believe this book says second quarter investment review for period ended September 30th. Sorry about the second quarter. This is the third quarter. I think we've corrected that and sent back an electric version for the records, but apologize for that oversight. The European sovereign debt crisis was certainly one of the top headlines and probably the most pervasive force in the marketplace over the third quarter. It obviously is assuming a lot of presence in the mind of market participants. There's fear of contagion beyond Greece, which has clearly been affected and is negotiating a bailout, or maybe not, or maybe a new government. Or maybe not. it's very difficult to watch because it changes so rapidly. But clearly, that weighed on the markets. Greece is manageable for the European Economic Union. However, it's pretty clear to see that any spillover, perhaps to Italy, the third largest debtor in the sovereign bond market, would be very challenging for Europe to control and perhaps the global debt markets. On the domestic front, on August 5th, Standard & Poor's went ahead and downgraded the long-term sovereign debt rating of the United States from AAA to AA+. It was not just the fact that the U.S. economic picture from a fiscal standpoint seems to be perpetually lagging, but that the our leaders in Washington failed to agree to failed to reach an agreement to cut the budget deficit. In fact, appointed a super committee to do so, and that super committee is now debating. So one thing to note in Standard & Poor's downgrade is that it's not a matter of the United States' ability to meet its fiscal, or pardon me, its debt obligations. It's a matter of its willingness to pay them. That seems to be, and to reach an agreement to bridge the gulf between tax receipts and outlays.
Refresh my memory, what's the deadline for that committee?
Thanksgiving.
It's almost time.
The 23rd, I believe,
November.
Is the date.
And they don't have a plan.
It appears, there's very little news about it. It does appear that, I think Boehner on Meet the Press yesterday said that it was quote-unquote difficult. So that's not a great, as far as we are into the process now, that's certainly not a great outcome. Despite the downgrade in treasuries rallied significantly through the quarter. In most instances, you would assume that a downgrade would correspond to a sell-off in an issuer. In this case, in the confluence of events, particularly with Europe, this actually led to a flight to quality to U.S. treasuries. And as a consequence, they were the strongest performers in the fixed income markets as a sector. A couple more notes from the Federal Reserve. In August, they said that they would keep rates low until 2013. Seems to be a pretty big commitment from the Federal Reserve to keep the Fed funds rate low for that long. It was also something that gave the markets, I think, a little bit of pause in what the Fed may be looking at if they seem to think that they can go ahead and make a announcement as to where they'll be 24 months from what was, where they stood in August. They also announced a new policy, Operation Twist. This is a tactic in which they'll issue short-term treasury debt and buy long-term treasury debt with the desired effect of flattening the yield curve, bringing down long-term rates, particularly to provide lower financing costs or lower costs for mortgage borrowers. So, two things coming out of Federal Reserve. They are still not quote-unquote out of bullets, so to speak, though it would seem their ammunition stores of policy are getting thin, and they are still active in the marketplace.
Well, Bernanke, this week, he's going to make some decisions on QE3?
Yes.
This week? What's your opinion on that?
I think that they will probably go ahead and do that. And the reason is that the administration has been pushing on a number of fronts to allow more people to refinance their mortgages to try to put more money into the
focus is going to be on mortgage-backed securities.
It will be. It will be. If they go forward. It seems that though the recovery is very slow, for sure, there is a recovery and there may be some wisdom to reserving all of the, keeping something in case we slip back into recession, which some argue we may be in already, others say no. But it looks like from a administration standpoint that there is a lot of impetus to try to push forward policies that allow for more mortgage refinancing at lower rates. And the HARP program was extended to provide for more of that. They reduced the or eliminated the loan-to-value criteria for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac mortgages for borrowers who are current on their mortgage but have loans that are more than 125% loan-to-value. They've also eliminated some of the loan-level pricing adjustments so that the rate of the mortgages would be less expensive, that people aren't getting having extra basis points put on their mortgage rate for high loan to value, lower FICO scores. Some of the risk metrics that were put in place to try to rein in mortgage lending that seemed to be somewhat out of control in the earlier part of, or I should say the mid-2000s. Now the administration is using those policies or eliminating those policies to try to push this agenda of making more people eligible to refinance their mortgages at lower rates. Our outlook for Q4, clearly we're underway in Q4 here, but certainly after the third quarter, from what we saw in Europe and in the marketplace, the possibility of another recession, even a global one, has grown. A lot of volatility in the marketplace, and that can have a dampening effect on economic activity. I don't think I need to speak much more about Greece. It's clearly, clearly at the edge, and they did come up with a 50% haircut, i.e., a voluntary 50% haircut that they were going to try to persuade Greek debt holders to agree to, which wouldn't trigger a default necessarily in terms of the derivatives contracts, but would mean that debt holders would receive 50% of the principal value of their securities and perhaps lower interest payments. Even after that initial rate was agreed to by policymakers in Europe and across Europe, we saw that Greece came back and said, we're not sure that we really want this, and caused the proposal for a referendum, clearly a very fluid situation still. On the domestic front, the super committee, we are, I'd say we're hopeful, but we are also, our expectations are pretty tempered. We think that really could bring about a situation where the level of discontent with Washington would be even higher than it already is, which is pretty high as we stand. While, as we saw a couple weeks ago with the announcement about the ESF and an agreement on Greek sovereign debt that caused markets to rally, often the devil's in the details, and we see that we have periods of risk on or rally and followed by periods of spread widening. In bank and finance, in the corporate sector, this volatility has been pretty straining on market participants, not only of many of those banks that participate in the trading of fixed income currency and commodities seen a lot of volatility, but losses in some of those groups, and it's caused some noise on balance sheets, and obviously some deterioration in the earnings of those firms. We noted here that we're, unfortunately, we believe that we're going to continue to see high rates of unemployment and ongoing weakness in the housing market. In October, employers added 80,000 jobs. While that's certainly positive, if you think back to the $8.8 million jobs that were lost in this great recession, there's only been 2.3 million jobs brought back on. So certainly some of this employment unemployment may be structural in nature, but nonetheless, that's a headwind on the economy that's causing very, very slow growth.
Was that net of job losses?
The 80,000, yes, so 80,000 new jobs were created. So that, it's certainly positive, but it takes about 150,000 a month to grow with the population and start to take down that jobless level. So, or that jobless rate. We saw the unemployment rate tick, I think, from 9.1 to 9%. But it's going to take more than 80,000 a month to continue to push that lower. The good news was that September was revised up I want to say it was from $106,000 to $150,000 or so. Don't have the figures at hand, but the decline in the unemployment rate was actually a function of prior revisions. For those that watch the unemployment rate, it seems that it's a very, it's a number that's very subject to revision and sometimes pretty significant revision. So just as when we're watching the unemployment rate, we're eager to see what happened, the first week of every month for the last month, but we're also eager to see what happened in terms of revisions for prior months, particularly if we're adding jobs and raising those rates. In Stable Rivers strategy, we have positioned portfolios with no direct exposure to sovereign debt. This means, as well as we didn't hold any, Italian or Greek or French or whatnot sovereign bonds, but we did hold earlier in the year dollar-denominated U.S. market issued bonds for the European Investment Bank, KfW, which is a German government-sponsored development bank. So we sold securities in the third quarter, sold those securities. We also eliminated exposure or sought to eliminate exposure to European financial and industrial sectors. An example in this portfolio was Total SE. It's an oil and gas operation. It's a French company, and we sold that as well. It's French, but it's has a big presence in Europe. From a duration standpoint, we'll continue to keep our short to neutral duration bias. We don't have a great conviction that rates are going to rise anytime soon. In fact, with Operation Twist, we think that should apply some technical pressure to the short end of the market and a little technical pressure to the long end of the market. We believe that a laddered portfolio or a laddered yield curve position is warranted. Again, given the instability in the interest rate markets, it's very hard to make a determination as to how the shape of the yield curve will change over the quarter. And it's also been, as I think all of us will note, very unstable. So we want to take a pretty neutral position there. We'll use periods of risk on to lower the overall corporate exposure and raise exposure to treasuries, agencies, high-quality asset backs, and government mortgage-backed securities. We've done some of that already in the portfolio. We will seek to reduce bank and finance exposure, as well as consumer cyclical exposure. I think this was a function of a downgrade that we did sell out Bank of America out of the portfolio. I think that's probably what I wanted to cover there. I'll show a couple of graphs in the following pages that I thought were kind of interesting. If you turn to page 5, these are 3-year spreads, 3-year bank and brokerage and basic industry and capital goods spreads. The top line, the blue line, is the bank and brokerage names. You see a pretty pronounced move in the third quarter of spread widening there. Not as much in the basic industry and capital goods, but clearly that sell-off in bank and finance was a driver of performance over the quarter. Down below, the 5 and the 10-year, the 5 years, we didn't see an awful lot of movement, but it was pretty pronounced at the long end of the curve, as you can see with the top blue line for the 10-year. On page 6, we talked about the super committee, we talked about S&P downgrading the U.S. long-term sovereign debt rating as a function of the inability for the parties and our leaders in Washington to get together to try to solve the, raise the debt ceiling and start to solve the budget deficit. Here, this just gives us a sense between outlays and receipts at the federal level, you know, the problem that we face. Obviously, that's a pretty large gulf there. The chart below that get a picture of European sovereign debt. Clearly, Greece has skyrocketed with the, you know, the likelihood of a default. On the next page, a couple of things to keep in mind. I think many people are, you know, watch the Case-Shiller Home Price Index. It has been relatively flat, you know, until the backlog of foreclosed homes are sold. You know, it's unlikely that we're going to see much change here in terms of home values. That's something that's obviously weighing on the consumer very, very heavily. Finally, in the bottom, we've charted the growth of employment out of recessions. And if you look at the current line, the thick, dark green line, you get a sense of, you know, the problem that we're having at adding jobs back and the slowness that's taken place from a pretty high level of unemployment to a scenario even after the recession ended where we're having, you know, we're just slow to add jobs back.
Tell me about the X and Y axis. What am I looking at there?
Okay, so the Y axis here is the, essentially it's a baseline or a trough, the trough being 100. You get a sense from the, you know, the level of about 105 and a half, where we were in terms of the, you know, the level of employment. We had a very high level of employment. We certainly, it shrunk very quickly. The, these are months on the bottom, zero being the end of the recession. So, you know, what we're seeing here is that 26 months after the end of the recession, you know, we're slowly adding jobs back.
Mark, a quick question if I could,
sure,
before we leave the strategy section.
Yep.
So basically, it sounds like the strategy is to continue to move away from corporate exposure.
Yes.
Some might view this environment as opportunistic since they've cheapened in value so dramatically, but your strategy is to continue to move away. So obviously your expectations are for continued deterioration in that sector.
That's correct. That's correct. We think over the fourth quarter, particularly as we get into year end, that we'll see, now this certainly depends on what happens in Europe, but we may see some spread widening there, and part of that is because those bank and finance groups that, or pardon me, those broker dealers who are make markets in the corporate debt markets, we think at the year end will be pretty shy about extending their balance sheet for client business, and that's going to cause some spread widening in corporate bonds.
Okay, so it's more market tactical, if I can phrase it that way.
Yes, I think that's
long-term economic-oriented strategy.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. In fact, you know, I think we see in corporate bonds a opportunity building, but we're not sure tactically if this is the right time to add to corporate securities. In fact, we think over the fourth quarter it would probably be a good time to unload certain names in periods of strength when, you know, the market seems to be a little bit more risk-on oriented, and wait to add until later quarters.
Okay, thanks.
I think I'm gonna skip page 8 and go right to page 9. Page 9 is a picture of the yield curve month end by month end, over the quarter, gives folks a good snapshot of, you know, just what happened. Obviously, rates rallied pretty significantly, and, you know, it seemed to be, though there was some volatility in rates through at least the third quarter, a pretty steady move for lower yields, and that was really driven by the, you know, the long end of the curve. I'm flipping now after tab two to the performance section. For the quarter, we generated a return in the portfolio of 2.56%. This is versus the benchmark return of 2.53. The benchmark is the, or is the new benchmark now, the Merrill Lynch 1 to 10 domestic master A or better. We've obviously, well, not obviously, but we've blended those benchmarks for historical performances from June 1st, or pardon me, May 31st, retroactively. Year-to-date portfolio return is 419 basis points versus the benchmark at 421. A little, moving forward to page 11, a couple of points to note on the portfolio characteristics summary. The effective duration at 3.5 years, the domestic master as of 9/30 had an effective duration of 3.22, yet it started the quarter at 3.92 and ended the quarter at 3.22. The longer mortgage component that the domestic master held relative to our benchmark, as rates rallied throughout the quarter, the benchmark went through a significant shortening in duration due to expectations of refinance activity within that longer mortgage portfolio. Our mortgage portfolio is shorter duration in nature and didn't experience the same shortening of duration as rates fell throughout the quarter. And as a consequence, we were really, we managed our duration fairly neutral to the benchmark, but saw a big move at the end of the quarter. We're not, it's not our intent to be longer than the benchmark from a duration standpoint. If that, you know, if that shortness in the, or if the benchmark continues to remain relatively short, will allow some of the duration in the portfolio to run off without extending it by buying longer securities through this quarter. Still have a yield advantage in the portfolio. You know, we think that this will help over market cycles to, or over the market cycle, I should say, to add some incremental income relative to the portfolio. From a distribution of security standpoint, our treasury position at 9/30 was about 23.5%. You know, we expect that may rise a little bit, but I think you'll also note in our portfolio the treasury exposure, though, was certainly lower than the 1 to 10 domestic master. It tends to be a little bit longer in duration, and that was a benefit to us in the quarter. So, you know, that was one of the sources of return relative to the benchmark. Also, our financial institutions and industrial exposure, though higher, our security selection benefit, as we seem to have a little bit less affected or higher quality securities that didn't sell off as much in the financial and the industrial space, in the spread widening that took place over the third quarter.
I have a question.
Sure.
Do you have a large cash balance? You waiting for an opportunity, or?
I think that's just a function of pay downs. No, we're not trying to build a cash balance opportunistically or, looking to shorten duration with cash. I think this is just a function of receiving some pay downs and coupon payments and maturities, and we'll continue to deploy that. So no, that isn't part of our strategy. In fact, we think we have enough liquid securities that if we wanted to take advantage, from a treasury standpoint, an agency standpoint, as well as some of the securitized bonds, that we can liquidate those pretty quickly and deploy that into something else if we needed. I think, unless there are other questions, then I will turn it over.
I have a couple of questions. Stepping back down to worldwide economic performance, what are the emerging economies doing? China, India, and Brazil.
The emerging economies, unfortunately, if you take a look at one of the places that you can see some of the global economic activity was this slide that we skipped on page 8, the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index. The Goldman Sachs Commodity Index is a basket of commodities, but you get to see that the emerging markets, which tend to be the producing nations, if you will, have seen demand cooling for sure, and that's been reflected in the commodity index. But it's probably not surprising that we've seen a lot of economic growth in the past couple of years in the emerging or developing economy or developing nation economies. However, that has really slowed down with their largest market, i.e. Europe, slowing and teetering on recession, as well as the United States. So our demands for their goods is waning somewhat, and that is putting a lot of pressure on them. So we can't necessarily look for, while China certainly has massive reserves that they could add, it come to the aid of Europe, we can't expect that their growth is enough to hold the developed nations out of a recession or quasi-recessionary environment. In fact, it's probably reasonable to assume the opposite, that as long as these recessionary or quasi-recessionary environments are, perpetuate in Europe and the United States, that demand for their goods and services will be diminished to a certain extent.
Thank you.
Yep.
With that being said, I'd like to make a motion that we accept the Stable River report.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Motion.
Thank you.
Very good. Mel Hamilton will be presenting the PFM's results for the September.
Okay. Just a couple observations in tab one, just kind of a market update. Mark talked about the risk on, risk off scenario that we've basically had for several years now, and obviously the third quarter was one of those scenarios where risk came off the table and everybody wanted to buy treasuries. And he outlined the reasons for that. So let me kind of put that in perspective. Is just a couple comments there. On page A1, the flight to quality was the driver, the whole emphasis of the third quarter, most of that came latter half of the quarter, second half of August and September. You know, a lot's been said about Europe, a lot's been said about the you know, questions about the economic growth, and you know, I think a lot of that just drove you know, the market, long-term investors in particular, to you know, look for a safe place to park securities. And not necessarily short securities, but long-term securities, because with defense policies, basically rates of return on short treasuries are effectively zero. So there was strong demand for buying any type of treasury that had any type of yield associated with it at all. And the net effect of that was you know, the largest quarterly return that we've seen in about 3 years from treasury securities. You see that on page A2. There's a little chart there on the top left-hand side. You know, talks about, just shows there how treasury rates, and you know, if you look at the two-year sector, which is one that we talk about a lot because we're in that 1 to 3 year space, which is, you know, right along the two-year space, you know, you see that two-year treasuries, you know, ended the quarter, September 30th, at 24 basis points, whereas they ended the second quarter, June 30th, at 46 basis points. So rates in 2 years dropped, you know, 22 basis points, which, you know, roughly half of what they were at the beginning of the quarter, which is in relatively stark contrast to the longer maturities. And if you look at the five-year, you know, five-year treasuries declined from 176 to 95, or 81 basis points. So from a total return perspective, clearly the longer you were, the better, and the more treasuries you had, the better. You know, we're starting to see some of that change already as we move into the fourth quarter, but that's really the situation we saw in the third quarter. On page A3, top left-hand page, there's a chart there that puts some of those changes on a total return basis. So in the 1 to 3 year, this is the Merrill Lynch Treasury Index. The 1 to 3, the index for the quarter, the light blue line there, 49 basis points. Compared that to some longer-term treasury indexes, you know, the 1 to 5 was 139, or you know, 1 to 10 was 360. So, you know, obviously that kind of, on a total return basis, the longer you were, the better you were.
I just want to interject right now, because we did take an adjustment. Mm-hmm. Mark's return is going to be a lot larger than yours, sure, because you're in the short term.
Yeah.
And that's, and you're judged on your own scope of your...
Well, I understand. I'm just kind of putting things in perspective.
Yeah.
You know, to let everybody know that this is basically what the quarter provided last year. And, you know, obviously, you know, I think the reason the structuring the portfolio the way you have makes all the sense in the world. But this is one of those quarters where we really kind of expose, for better or for worse, you know, the range of returns you can get when you do that. You know, strategically, you know, things revert to the norm. So, you know, we think we'll come back to, you know, the norm side of it, but that's what the quarter was. You know, Mark talked a little bit about, you know, Operation Twist, which, you know, contributed some to that as well, because, you know, with the Treasury selling short-term securities and buying longer-term securities, a flattening of the curve there as well. So not quite the steep yield curve that we had once upon a time, but from a strategy standpoint, we still think there's value, you know, going out the curve, you know, rolling down the curve, you know, and buying that longer term security for as long as you can. And from our perspective, within our mandate, you know, that's, you know, extension to us is kind of 2 to 3 years, because if you look at on page tab 2, B2, you know, the effective duration, the blue box there on the left-hand side, of our portfolio is about a year and a half, 157, versus the index of 176, which, as you point out, Rick, and as Mark said, I mean, duration on Stable River is about twice that.
In about 3 years.
Yeah,
and it's a 4% return versus a 1%.
Exactly. So, you know, so the duration was a component of the return when you're looking at trying to compare the returns. But really, if you go to the next page, it's actually a little more deeper than that, because the Merrill Lynch index for the 1 to 3 index, as you see there, was 80% treasuries. And obviously with that drop in rates, you know, that contributed 39 basis points of that index's 46 basis point return. So treasuries were the primary component, which is materially different than our portfolio, because we only had about 28% in treasuries in the portfolio, and we actually own some corporates as well. And again, as Mark said, with the spread widening in corporates, you know, corporates tended to underperform. We're very comfortable with the corporates we own. We do own some five financials. If you look at the holdings, you know, we own Goldman Sachs, Wells Fargo, Credit Suisse, J.P. Morgan. Most of those names are FDIC guaranteed because they were issued during the finance program, so we're not concerned about credit quality. And yield to maturity on that corporate portfolio, based on your cost, is 233 basis points. So, from our perspective, we're getting a good return on the corporate portfolio, even though, the spreads changed, caused the market values to trade off. But, 230 on basically FDIC guaranteed corporates, for the most part, it's comparable to, where 10-year treasuries have been trading of late. So, we continue to own corporates. Dave asked the question as far as value. We actually do think there's some value there, so we actually would look to add corporates, though that's not necessarily within our mandate, so we don't want to get too carried away with it because we're really a treasury agency mandate. So we're comfortable owning the corporates that we have, but I kind of jumped ahead of myself. We go back to B2. The quarterly return on your portfolio was 29 basis points. It was less than the index, 46, as I just said, primarily because of the allocation that we had to corporates and stuff. On a year-to-date basis, it's much more in line, 192 versus 184. And then on a 12-month basis, we're a little bit ahead of the index. So we're comfortable with our strategy, and we basically look at the third quarter as one where we saw a lot of unusual things happening. They may continue to happen. Nobody knows where Europe is going to end up, Greece or Italy or Spain or any of those, situations over there. But from a strategy standpoint, we continue to believe in the diversification. Like I said, we like the corporate sector. It provides good yield at the current part. If you look at page B5, a little bit of breakdown on the maturity structure that we've got in place at the present time. September 30th is the allocations that we ended up with, and you see on the light blue there that we're very heavily in the 6 to 12 months and the 1 to 2 year range, which with a year and a half portfolio, that's pretty much where you would expect us to be. That's actually the kind of steepest part of the curve without getting out any further, so it doesn't make a lot of sense to hold a lot of cash. There's a couple of short-term maturities there in the 6-month range that basically represent to us some dry powder that we could harvest some gains, which we did a little bit of that in the third quarter. But basically the gist of it is we're in that 18-month sector, which is particularly evident there when you see what the changes that we made in the 2 to 3 year sector, which we had a lot more in 3 years. Now it's kind of shifted into the 2 year range. Longer term, we're pretty much in line with the index. So really our call, and which is in line with our mandate, and also really where the steepness of the curve is in that 12 to 18 month sector with the portfolio. So we're perfectly comfortable buying a 3-year security, maybe a treasury, though lately what we've been buying is agencies. Callable agencies have come back in a little more value from our perspective in callable agencies than what there was once upon a time. So we're perfectly happy buying a 2 or even 3 year treasury or agency and holding it for 6 months and then selling it and hopefully taking the benefit of the roll down and doing it again. Composition of the portfolio is summarized there on page C1 with the assets there. I mentioned the corporate holdings there. The rest of the corporate stuff is pretty much household names: Walmart, John Deere, Johnson & Johnson, IBM. So we're not concerned with credit quality in any of those, and just continue to like it from the coupon that they're providing us. Any questions regarding what we're doing, why we're doing it?
Okay. That being said, I'd like to make a motion to approve the PFM report for September 30th.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Motion carried. The last advisor, David Forfine, the Sawgrass, again, a different sector, we're in the middle.
Not too hot, not too cold.
Just right.
Never been confused, I've never been confused for Goldilocks, but we'll proceed. We'll take a snapshot of performance, top of page 2. Very strong performance across all fixed income assets. You'll notice that your portfolio that Sawgrass manages did come in with a 53 basis point return for the quarter, about a 2% annualized rate, stronger than we thought 3, 4, 5, 6 months ago. Underperforming its current benchmark, we're going to get into that. A lot of what you've just heard is the drivers of that. Got some nice exhibits of what we see going forward as well. You'll see that as the periods extend out further, some nice outperformance over the benchmark, 3 years, 5.30 versus just over 4.5. You've seen, well, okay. Let's just jump forward. You've seen that the graphs on the yield curve with interest rates falling. Take a look at it on a total return report on page 4. This is a broader array of indices beyond that of which this particular fund is investing in. But what you'll see is, take a look at the long treasuries. These are treasury bonds beyond 10 years to maturity. For the quarter, unannualized, they returned over 24.5% return. That's when you add their coupon plus their price change. Many sectors of the treasury market today are more volatile on a daily basis than their annual yield to maturity. You can see moves 3-4% up one day, down the next day, up the third day, down more than the yield to maturity. When Mel and Mark said we are in a volatile market, they should have stood up on the table and screamed we're in a volatile market. I'll save that for you. I'm more than happy to do it. You'll notice that much of the other indices are all kind of lumped in together. So it wasn't whether you had finance names or industrial names or whether you had 1 to 3 or whether you had 1 to 5. It's whether you had long treasuries or you didn't have long treasuries. We happen not to have in the 1 to 5 space not as many 5-year treasuries as the index had. Let's do a little quick math. We detail it on the page 5. The top left box, total return, I've separated the index. These are just index numbers, nothing about Sawgrass's investments. This is your benchmark into government bonds and non-government bonds. So treasuries and agencies are on the top line and corporate bonds are in the bottom line. And if you cut them in half and say 1 to 3 years are the shorter and 3 to 5 years are the longer in the index, very simplistic 2x2 matrix. You'll notice that the long government bonds for the quarter alone returned over 2.7% return. The credit were negative total return, meaning their prices didn't compensate, more than compensated for the income coming in a negative fashion. And the short governments didn't do too much in total. But take a look at the allocation at the bottom box underneath it. This is the composition of the index as it stands at the end of the quarter. It's not quite 25% in each of the 4 boxes. You'll see that you have a significant amount in the government as the treasuries are issuing more to cover the current deficits. So your indexes, all 3 of your different indices, are increasing in their contribution to government bonds, specifically treasuries, compared to 2 years ago or compared to 4 years ago. It's a significant component of treasuries that's increasing. The long government bonds in this index, 3 to 5 year government bonds, make up 28%. If you take that 28% times the 2.7, you get 76 basis points of return is just attributable to those 3 to 5 year treasury securities. The index was only 90, so you got about 80% of the return if you owned 3 to 5 year treasuries. Now, I didn't own as much as I would have liked to in the past, and the reason why is the yield to maturities in the box. I've taken those same distributions and on the right side of the page what are you getting paid to purchase those going forward? And you'll see that the long government sector is less than 3/4 of 1% annual yield to maturity. That means if you're going to hold them to maturity and let them hold for 4 years on average, you're going to get 75 basis points each year. Not all that significant of a contribution. Whereas if you buy the corporate bonds, they're over 2% return in each of those years. So if you multiply that times 4, the contribution to the corporate bonds is significantly higher. We've seen some graphs on the movement. So that's the rationale that we have to be investing and investing more heavily in the credit space now. You've seen some graphs. My graph on page 6 is comparable to a graph, I think Mark was in Mark's book. Mark showed a 3- or 4-year period. This is only a 1-year period. I wanted to get a graph that took out 2008 when yield spreads went to the moon and just focus in on what's happening on the recent time periods. And what my graph shows is that Treasury yields are lower relative to corporate bonds, or the way that this graph shows it, corporate bonds are paying more yield relative to Treasuries. And we are taking this opportunity to increase our exposure to the corporate bonds to the extent that your policy allows. I'm limited to a 50% weighting of corporate bonds, so one of the interesting things we're doing is, because interest rates are low, and I don't think they're going to get much lower than they are in this index, and in order to not breach your 50% limit on corporate bonds, I'm selling some of the shorter corporate bonds, buying some of the longer corporate bonds. Now, I don't like buying longer bonds when I think interest rates are too low, so what we're doing is we're buying floating rate bonds. So let me give you an example. We might have a 2-year JP Morgan bond fixed. We'll sell that and buy a 5-year floating rate JP Morgan bond that will adjust to the current interest rates every quarter. So you'll have a lower coupon, but a much greater yield to maturity because you're getting 5 years of credit risk as opposed to 2 years. So we're able to add yield, same credit risk, and less interest rate duration or sensitivity. So a shorter, more defensive interest rate posture and a little bit more aggressive on the credit mix while still staying within your policy. The way us guys might want to say it is we've increased the contribution to duration of the credit space. The interesting thing about it is if we take a broader index, the entire corporate bond universe, it might be more appropriate for the Barclays Capital Aggregate, what you'd see in a pension portfolio. This page 7 slices that out by interest rate spreads to treasuries. So what you see is the more highly rated securities will be on the left, and the ones that offer more yield spread are to the right. And what we have here is 3 different time periods. We've got before the crisis in yellow. You'll see that all of the bonds were trading at a very small amount of spread to treasuries. You weren't getting incremental yield to own those bonds. The light blue distribution is at the beginning of this calendar year, and you'll see that things are spread out a little bit more, and they're even spread out a little bit more today. What we're suggesting is that with the proper credit work, there's more of an opportunity to outperform with issuer selection than there was in past time periods. So we're taking some of that time periods and trying to find the good names to own within your portfolio. Give you an example of what makes me so comfortable maxing out, if you will, your credit exposure. On page 8, we've got 2 different graphs here. The green one, which uses the left axis, is the top 30 Dow Jones industrial issuers, their net debt, how much debt do they have outstanding, divided by their earnings, their income, specifically their EBITDA. So what we're saying is how much earnings do they have for it? And you'll notice that green line is going down. So they either have less debt today, or they have greater earnings, or a combination of the both, which is more likely what they do have. And you see that measure of creditworthiness is improving throughout the industries. The red line is that same red line that we showed a couple of slides back that shows the interest that you're getting paid to own them relative to owning other securities. And you see that you're getting paid more to own them at a time period when their creditworthiness is improving. So you get the best of both worlds. If you wanted to go specifically, I know that the area of focus that we should all be paying attention to is the bank and finance sector. You've heard a lot about what's going on with Bank of America, maybe Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley. Don't know if you know a firm, MF Global, just declared bankruptcy. It was a smaller, less widely held investment bank wannabe. They went out and hired John Corzine, a former chairman of Goldman Sachs, who seems to know a thing or two about running investment banks or being a state senator for a time period. He decided to lever up the risk as much as possible and did it through the European sovereign debt at the wrong time and with great leverage, and those two things got him. We had no dealings with MF Global, no investments with MF Global. Many, many firms have that same who are they approach. So from one side of the coin, you're safe and we can go ahead and ignore the event. But now what it shows is, ooh, if it can happen to them, could it happen too? And then move on to the next low-hanging fruit. So now the conversation is circling around Jefferies, another investment bank that's not as big as Morgan Stanley or Goldman Sachs. And they're coming out saying, hey, why are you looking at me? I'm perfectly safe and sound. And they're actually giving out as public information their holdings lists down to the CUSIP level as a way to defend a run on their bank. Unheard of in this industry where it's like, hey, trust me, I'm keeping my stuff hidden and there's no reason that you need to look at it, but trust me, these guys are just opening the doors, saying anybody want to come on in, take a look. We've taken a look at the top five banks here. This is on page 9, JP Morgan, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, U.S. Bank Corp, and BB&T. And we've averaged some of the characteristics on there, and it shows a vastly improving situation for their balance sheet. They've got lots of capital. They've got lots of access to capital. They have improving non-performing assets, and they have higher than expected reserves for potential losses. It's just all of the metrics that you're looking at are improving and are very strong. So I'm not worried about any of the names in the portfolio. Maybe one time we need to talk about are the names too consistent across all three of your portfolios, but there's some broad diversification and lots of different holdings. We have a 2% or less issuer concentration limit in our portfolio. So it's 2% of the money we're running for you. So when you divide that by your whole funds, it's a much less significant amount if one were to go south. So there's our investment thesis, short on interest rates, long on credit, and generating the returns. It was a strong return with a 50 basis point return, underperforming the benchmark. The credit index was actually negative for the quarter. So to be able to be as invested in a negative returning asset class and delivering a positive return is a mark to show that our security selection is adding value. I mentioned the floating rate securities. The last thing I'd want to point out is the advantage in the yield to maturity on a mark-to-market basis at the end of the quarter. It has been some time since our portfolio has had a positive yield to maturity relative to that of the benchmark. Benchmark being the 1-5 A or better gov credit is 88 basis points at the end of the quarter. It's even a little bit lower now. And your portfolio is over 1.25%. So 35 or so basis points yield to maturity advantage to sit and hold. That doesn't compensate, that doesn't include the potential gains on the roll down and some of the spread improvement that we anticipate going forward. So we're very confident looking forward. Are there any questions?
One about the cash. You have close to $2 million. Is that just a...
I do believe that's just transitory in terms of what something matured right at the end of the quarter. You've got your cash as of the end of the next month. If I can read this small font, it was about the same. So we're moving it around. We recently sold a bond, one of the strongest credits in your portfolio in terms of the credit, Abbott Laboratories. Big conglomerate pharmaceutical firm just decided that they think they can unleash some economic value for their shareholders by breaking up into two companies. Well, that doesn't do much for a bondholder. You don't know where your bonds are going to go, or you're going to go with this half or that half. So we just took the opportunity to liquidate it, and we reinvested that in a different credit for you. It's interesting how these trends go. Investment banks need to make money by doing deals. 5 years ago, they were doing deals by making conglomerates because of the diversification. Now everybody's a big conglomerate, and they need to be talked into breaking up into smaller, more specific industries to get the maximum value. So that was one of the reasons we have some cash currently.
Any other questions?
Thanks to the creativity and the closing is a way
to accept
working around the report policy.
Staying second. All in favor?
Aye.
Motion carried. All right. Last guy up, as far as advisors, Bogdan, Dave West will be presenting his the total scenario for all the managers.
Okay. We've had an excellent overview and economically and a great idea. I think it's interesting. We've got a couple managers running maybe strategically different ways, but at the end of the day, from listening to this and looking at how the portfolio positions have changed, your active managers are active. And that's a good thing, and hopefully, we get through all this. I mean, number one, from a compliance standpoint, let me hit that one first. There are no issues. All of your managers have successfully avoided any headline. There are no downgrades, no holdings of consequence if you scan the price list, as we used to have to do and bring things to attention on an almost regular basis. All securities are priced, in and around, a par. There's no big discounted price securities. So from a compliance standpoint and an activity standpoint, managers are doing a good job. We haven't had any issues we've had to address. Second, from a structure standpoint, as Rick pointed out, we unfortunately out of the gate with this restructuring more to a liability-driven investment portfolio, okay, where we obviously did benefit by having Stable River in the longer dated maturities this particular go-around. Now, we could have a flip side quarter where rates go up, and then they're going to be fighting against interest rates going up. But again, because those are longer dated liabilities, we have time that we can work with those mark-to-markets and hopefully at the end of the day get a higher return out of that longer dated, higher risk for, but I want to be careful in how we say that, portfolio. And also, as you pointed out, each of the portfolios kind of came in about where you would expect on a return basis in this environment. So I guess a question or a confirmation question, if I start in our report on page 17, here's the current allocations to the three managers of September 30th. Just looking at that snapshot, the bar chart above kind of gives us a bubble of the little bit above below estimates. to the targets, and then the table down below gives the hard dollars and the actual percentage allocation there. As we should do every quarter, just want to make sure there aren't any changes as far as the liabilities go, make sure we don't need to move any money from the longer dated pool to the shorter dated pool, or vice versa. Do we have additional surplus that might be moved out? We just want to check in with you on that on a quarterly basis. So I'm sorry, maybe that was a bad choice of term. Any dollars that might be extended, the investment period might be extended.
I would suggest not doing that unless we vary within 2% of the target. Mm-hmm. So, and we're within 2%. So as long as the horse race stays the same at this time, I don't think that we need to make a movement.
Okay.
And basically, we're at 40% with Sawgrass, 30% is our target with PFM, and then 30% with Stable River. And again, I'm being the leader here because I think that that's the guidelines that we need to look at. And again, one time, one of these other managers might be more aggressive than the other manager. So it's, you never put all your eggs in one basket, and you just keep it spread so that we make the financial needs of the city.
Okay.
Agreed?
Okay, let's take a look at cash flows, and I'll pull everyone together here on page 19. And if you follow with me in the shaded line at the top box there, there's the financial reconciliation for the quarter. The combined manager allocations opened with $165,555,072. No money movement between managers. Contributions. There's the distribution of where those monies went by manager, but roughly in total $32,729. No money leaving. Investment fees for the period, $32,729. No additional line item expense items were taken from the custodial statement for this period. So we break up the investment earnings into the income, which is obviously the bulk of the earnings. $1,032,168 combined. There was some capital appreciation during the period, and I think as reported, we largely know that the source of the securities that generated most of that, and that totaled $717,524. So we take the snapshot 9/30 with $167,304,764. Any questions on the quarter cash flow? And for the year then, if you just drop your eyes down to the lower box there, and I'll just focus on the income and capital appreciation. The income component was $4,594,830. And actually all in, we had a depreciation number of $896,467. So basically, about $3.75 million earned for your fiscal year on a dollar basis. So let's go to page 20 and convert dollars to percentages. And for the quarter, you can see the total fund net of investment management fees was up 1.04%. Pretty good quarter. The SBA is one of our very secondary, but certainly another area where money could be placed, barely squeaking out positive returns. Fiscal year basis, 2.12%. Again, halfway, well above the 26 basis points earned in the SBA pool. In both periods, investment returns were marginally below the benchmark. And our secondary peer group comparison for the total fund for the quarter, third percentile, and year over year, 18th percentile. And again, this report is actually the first report we have where we have a full quarter's worth of investments, where we're getting each manager on their very tight, very specific index And then we're also adjusting the peer groups, which per our previous conversations, unfortunately, the peer groups are a much looser, less precise tool, so we need to take that into consideration. In discussion with our performance group here, we chose, and this is open for discussion, but we chose to leave the total fund peer group the same as it was, even though we've extended maturities and durations. And our thought process behind that was that this is operating cash, and this is almost a decision to step outside of the benchmark, if you will, by, you know, laddering the three different strategies. So we should be looking at the opportunity cost or the opportunity gain relative to what was the peer group that was. And then secondarily, as you know, we do have very precise index measurement, which is taking place within. So this leaves the other issue still on the table, and that's that we do have to be aware that during certain periods of time, our fund, the total fund return, is going to have an unfair advantage to that peer group, and then certain periods of time, it's going to be flipped the other way. So whenever we discuss peer groups, as hopefully I've always communicated fairly, you know, we've got to take all things into consideration, and it will probably lead to a deeper discussion in using that tool. Okay, is everybody okay with that?
So basically, in your opinion, given what all the fund managers have said, and given the information we have on long-term interest rates, are we in a good place as far as having the 1-3 bucket and the 1-5 and then the 1-10? Should we basically allocate more to the longer term rates?
Okay, great question, and short answer I think would be yes, we are properly positioned. And I think the decision to allocate assets as they've been allocated would be coming actually less from a perceived market outlook than from the more accurately or precisely determined, you know, when are those dollars going to be called upon. So in the case of the longer dated pool, you know, that allocation has been determined by the fact that, look, we've got a lot of dollars here that it's a much longer dated liability. We're not going to have to call those dollars. And conversely, with you know, the PFM very short mandate, those dollars are going to be needed right away. So I think the allocation decision is more driven by the liability side. But now taking the next step and applying the market outlook, again, as I say, your managers are very active, so I think they are maneuvering appropriately to address the market environment. Is that my answering the question?
Pretty much. I was just kind of wondering if instead of basically just having the one fund manager on the 1-10, we could, I guess, in essence, allow them to have one basically at the 1-3, to where we can get those funds if we need to, and then allow the other two to invest in the longer term, knowing what we know about the market and the interest rates right now.
Okay.
As far as Fed funds rate being down till the middle of 2013 and the Operation Twist and everything else, we know that long-term interest rates can be fairly low.
I think that would be taking our long-term strategy, throwing it out the window for a short-term market gain is what that would do, because that would bust up our diversification. And our capital plan really drives where our dollars need to go versus what's going on quarter to quarter in the market. And so I don't think it would be prudent to abandon our long-term allocation strategy because this quarter things may be looking better and the yield curve is flattening. We need to, if you will, weather the storm with our long-term investment strategy. But the managers, because they're actively managing, are moving the bucket of dollars that they have according to what's going on with the market. So I think that's more apropos. We really can't afford to throw more money that way because we have some short-term liabilities coming up So we can't have it invested in a longer-term bucket, because when we go to build some of the CIP projects and we need to liquidate, we're going to take losses. So I think it's a combined approach. The long-term strategy's there, the buckets are determined by the CIP and what needs are coming up, but within those buckets, yeah, they're taking advantage of those long-term spreads. That would be my...
Yeah, and in fairness, great question.
Good idea.
Great.
4% is better than one.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's a balancing act, but there's also that risk-return trade-off that you have to make.
Exactly. And, you know, sitting here with 2020 vision, you know, I think it was probably, we could probably go back almost 2 years where, you know, we were all having a discussion and we were afraid interest rates were going to start going up. Mm-hmm. And that would have been a gross error in market call. And if we had moved cash between buckets based on that call, we would have been, you know, obviously 100% wrong. So depending upon these firms to make those short-term tactical calls, but keep the longer-term balances intact.
Cool.
Okay. If you take a look at, while we're on that page, I think I mentioned bench the fund benchmark there. Hop down to the next line. We've got Sawgrass again to the quarter returns reported. So we'll just note you know, a little bit of underperformance was discussed there. The peer group ranking there was 20th year-over-year basis with a little bit of underperformance to the index policy. That resulted in about an average peer group ranking there. The 3 and 5 year numbers, again, very strong, both index relative and peer group relative. Stable River, about on the benchmark, they handled the shift. Obviously, they had the most assets to recategorize or reshift the portfolio, if you will. Longer term numbers looking good there. What we're doing here is we're in that line, we're, you know, we continue to track that manager, so we're averaging in the new with the old, and we're making that, you know, index adjustment there as we continue the math, if that makes sense. And then the line down below it, now we've just started their new benchmark and new marching orders so that we can you know, track how they're doing for us lately there. PFM, again, also another manager that had to make some change. They, by our measures for the year, you know, continuing everything forward, was ahead of the benchmark and ended up, and we didn't put the...
I was going to say, some of your benchmarks are missed.
Yeah, that's going to be in the... We're going to have that in the back. I'll hold that thought. We'll go back there. And then PFM for the single quarter, you know, 44th percentile reported there. So let's go back. Let me see if I can pull that number up. Should have that in there for PFM. Yeah, if you drop back to page 32. Make a note to make sure that that gets included in that executive summary page there. But back in the depths of the book on page 32 for the quarter, we showed PFM 44th percentile and year over year 60th percentile, and the 3 and 5 years 27th and 14th percentile. And while we're on that page, the chart over on the right shows the cumulative performance. If you give them $100, what actually happened? We can talk, you know, percentage returns, we can talk peer group rankings, but at the end of the day, the $100, what did it do? The ups and downs, compounded performance, and you can see the blue line is well above the gray line. So they've done a good job for you on that. So back one page, page 31. And just FYI, as you go into the back of the book, here's where we're starting the new peer group assessment for Stable River. So just by example, this page, obviously it's only going to show one quarter, but we're going to start, you know, accumulating the same data and breaking it out that way. So those were the highlights of the book. Major points we wanted to make. Again, I covered compliance, no issues there.
The only one that I'm just questioning is on page 37, the total portfolio didn't make its portfolio exceed the target. We didn't exceed it for the year, nor did Sawgrass. The no's always get my attention.
But yeah, but for the 3 and 5 year policy periods, you're good.
Yeah.
And yes, it noted for the year that it was minuscule, but yes, there are two no's there.
Okay. I just want to make sure that was right.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Does anyone else have any questions or comments? That being said, I'd like to make a motion to approve the Bogdan report.
Second.
All approved. All in favor?
All right.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, David.
You're welcome.
And that brings it down to me. I just wanted to pick up the Treasury report that we have here. I wanted to just open it up to page 2. And I wanted you to note that we compared the earnings versus SBA, and had we put the money in SBA, we would have earned about $400,000. We employed about $160 million for the year, and our total return net of fees would have been $3.8 million. So going with independent investment advisors, we definitely came ahead. And the other point that I wanted to look at is the very top. You'll notice Sawgrass, their yield for 9 months was 2.3, PFM was 1.993, and Stable River was 4.18. Now, we're taking a little bit more duration with Stable River, and we couldn't get that return for everything. But using a blended market, blended duration, I think it's been a better situation for the city. And the last point I wanted to make is that the very last page, the cash position for the city, we've taken $35 million out of SunTrust and moved it over to SBA so that we could get a little bit better return. What that basically has given us is about $6,000 more every month. The top priority is we have to keep about $15 million over in SunTrust to meet the obligations of the city. This secondary fund is the SBA, and we have those funds available within 24 hours. A couple of notes. We've liquidated the $10 million in the construction bond accounts, and that they're sitting over in SunTrust right now. And there was a early refunding of bond 201A, and basically that cost the city about $4 million in cash for the quarter, but it was a net savings of $800,000 basically. So it was money that we had to spend and well meant. That being said, do you have any questions regarding the city's treasury?
Move to approve.
Move to approve. Second. All right. I have one little side note on the agenda. All the committee members, and I'm speaking to the choir here, all the committee members are required to have 8 hours of outside education course. PFM is offering a course on the 20th of January in Orlando. Whoever sits on this board really needs to go take to be aware of that.
Our city investment policy states we have to have 8 hours of CBD.
Yeah.
So if anybody wants to sign up for that, we'll get you signed up. It's in January. They give that course down in Orlando.
One day.
8 hours CP, that's what our investment policy says. We need is continuing ed.
We appreciate y'all putting that on for us.
Yeah, we've done that every year now, I think, for about 9 years. So it's a good chance for everybody to catch up on their CPE training. Yeah. And we do a couple of other things throughout the year. We did one in October. Now we have one coming up in December, too, and a little further, though, is in Fort Myers. Okay. So that's a little bit of a trek. But.
So if everybody's interested, we'll go ahead and RSVP for everybody and get us on the agenda there.
Does anyone have any other matters for the board? I'd like to make a motion that we adjourn.
Second. Yeah, can you hang it by just a few moments? Got a couple charges for you. Gentlemen, thank you. Appreciate your time.
Thank you all, and
thank you.
That'd be great.
Thank you. Good to see you.
Thank you. Likewise.
Good questions for him.
Yeah. I think when you go that's first,
you get all the tough economic questions. Yeah. Yeah.
Y'all flip.
Did y'all vote for Greece?
Tell me about from a layman's
perspective. Spain and Italy.
Gosh, you've got Greece, Ireland, you've got Portugal, you've got Spain, you've got Italy, who are kind of close to defaulting on the issue of this.